Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. This week, we've got a double interview special as we go behind the scenes on the making of two very different but exciting American independent movies, Black Bear and Let 'Em Play. Up first, I'm joined by the writer-director of Black Bear, Lawrence Michael Levine. Starring Aubrey Plaza, Christopher Abbott and Sarah Gaydon, it follows a filmmaker at a creative impasse who seeks solace from her tumultuous past at a rural retreat, only to find that the woods summon her inner demons in intense and surprising ways. And trust me, that description is only the tip of the iceberg of this incredibly surprising film. Black Bear is out stateside already, but will be out in the UK on all digital platforms from Friday the 23rd.
You're Allison?
Yeah, you're Gabe?
Hi, I'm Allison.
Oh, I know. I'm Blair.
You're really pretty.
You are too.
Used to be an actress and now you're a director. Why'd you give it up?
I didn't.
So do you guys have a plan for this place?
I don't really know what we're doing.
We were living in Brooklyn and it was getting so expensive and we weren't really working, so.
I figured if I never learned how to cook, then I would never become a housewife.
You're really hard to read.
Yeah, you know what? I get that all the time.
Do you find it weird acting in your own films?
I actually find it kind of humiliating.
Roll sound.
Mark. Okay, whenever you're ready. Action. You don't think she knows what I'm up to? She's oversimplifying a lot.
It's just so rare to pick a real artist's brain. How can you make something if you don't have anything to say?
I have something to say. I just think the movie is the only way to say it.
It's like she can't stand the fact that I have a single thought about this world.
No, it's that I can't stand the thoughts about the world that you have.
This has been so fun.
You don't love me anymore.
Leave me alone!
Now I'm wondering what kind of mind games you're playing with me.
He's my husband, okay?
Claire, can you just calm? Can you calm down
a little bit?
Me?
I've been lying since the second I got here.
You're in love with her. You are. I know it.
This is what you wanted, okay? This was going to ruin us.
Okay, cut.
I just want to be normal people again.
The film has a really interesting kind of narrative setup. What kind of came first for you? Was it the structure or was it the story? Or perhaps the characters?
I'd say the characters. I always start with characters. The germ of the idea came from a dream that I can no longer recall. I think I dreamed something that was similar to part one, but by the time, and I don't know why, I just thought this would make an interesting movie. And so I went to my office and I started to kind of recall what happened in this dream, but it was fragmentary. So I kind of fleshed out this dream that I had, just kind of writing it down. And then I started to think about characters. So that's usually where I start. I just think of a character and start to do a sketch on them. And then things usually follow from there.
How has it kind of evolved over time from that initial dream to here we are kind of talking about it, it's making its way more and more into the world? How long has it taken Black Bear to become a reality?
I started writing it in 2017. I think it took me about, I don't remember, 5 months maybe to write it. And then it took another year, possibly year and a half to find financing and start to shoot the movie. So I'd say about 2 years, and then it took another 8 months to edit. Yeah, I guess it was a 3-year process.
What attracted you to Aubrey Plaza for this leading role? I know you two have previously kind of worked together. What was it about maybe that experience and her kind of background that you thought she's perfect for this role?
I didn't think of the role before I met her. I knew her already and was had her in mind to do it. The movie is sort of cryptic and mysterious, and she's very cryptic kind of person. So in some way, her spirit informed the writing of the movie. So she was kind of in my mind when I was writing it, and then she was the first person I showed it to, like when I was casting. I showed it to my wife previously, who I always share things with.
What about for like kind of Christopher Abbott and Sarah Gadon? Were they sort of people that kind of came along in the casting process? Obviously, you had kind of Aubrey Plaza potentially in mind. Were these two people you also had in mind, or were they very much kind of people that were seen through the traditional sense?
They were people that I had in mind the second I started casting. So I wasn't envisioning them when I wrote the script, but the second I had to start thinking about casting, I had been eyeing both Sarah and Chris for a while. I saw Sarah in a movie called Indignation by James Shamus. It's a Philip Roth adaptation. And her performance in the movie is incredible. I suggest you check it out if you haven't seen it, but it was really incredible. And once in a while I'll see an actor and I'll just think, man, I would really like to get my hands on them and like work something together. And she was one of those people. And the same goes for Chris, who I actually tried to cast in another project of mine that didn't go anywhere, and he passed. But I wasn't dissuaded. I went after him again. Luckily, Sarah was Sarah's an agent with Aubrey, so he facilitated the connection.
The script and dialogue is incredibly biting. I mean, I was sitting on my couch watching it, feeling like I was watching like a contact sport. What do you draw upon to kind of bring this kind of dialogue to life?
Well, it's a combination of life experience and technique. When I was conceiving of the film, I was really reflecting a lot about my life as an quote unquote artist. You know, I was reckoning with the sacrifices that it takes to lead an artistic lifestyle, and it takes a toll because there's financial stresses associated with it. It takes a long time to get paid to do these kinds of things. Takes a toll on relationships and everything. So I was kind of at a point in my life where I was wondering if it had all been worth it. And I kind of plunged into the darker aspects of the previous two decades of filmmaking that I had done with my wife, who's a partner of mine on the majority of my projects. So that's kind of where it was coming from.
Is it interesting that a film like this has sort of dropped for a lot of people that are viewing it sort of during lockdown, and more people will have found sort of their relationships straining and kind of watching sort of Gabe and Blair become more relatable to them in sort of 2020, 2021 than perhaps when you were scripting it in 2017? Has it been interesting to sort of see a lot of people coming to a film like that going, oh wow, you know what, I think I said that to someone in the third month of lockdown or something like that?
Actually, to me, it's been more interesting how shocking and at times unrealistic people have thought that the dialogue was, because to me, there's nothing more realistic than that.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to work hard, and in my view, or at least I have, to be a civilized person. So in the movie, I was interested in dropping that veneer. And I've definitely seen and been involved in conversations that bitter and biting. I don't know, I wouldn't say it's an everyday thing, but I've definitely been there, and I've definitely witnessed it many, many times. Those moments when the veneer of civilization and civilized behavior kind of vanishes, and our words are basically just weapons to hurt, destroy, seduce, whatever. So that's kind of where it was coming from. I don't think it's very interesting to just watch like everyday conversations with no conflict. But it's interesting to me. I know maybe it's also a Jewish thing too. Like I'm Jewish and like everybody in my family and my extended family has this kind of wit and this kind of fighting vernacular. So I don't know.
How do you kind of create the tension? Like the film is unrelenting. Is it difficult to keep that intensity, energy and performances up, especially when you're sort of shooting at night as well, kind of time's ticking against you? How do you make sure like your actors are fresh, can keep that up for not just a whole night's kind of shooting, but for the duration of a film?
You know, in some ways I don't really view that as my responsibility. I think a lot more about my own energy. And preserving it. And I assume that my level of commitment and professionalism is an example for the people around me, which I'm not saying I always do, or maybe even I never did it, but it's definitely my intention to show that my commitment is unwavering and hope that that permeates the atmosphere of the set. But I can't make the actors energetic when they're not. Fortunately, the cast was incredibly energetic and really, really game. And never did anybody, it's the first film I think I've ever made where none of the actors said, "Larry, this is too much, too many takes, I wanna go home." That's happened to me on every single set I've ever been on. And as an actor, director, or anything, producer or anything. So. No, I never heard that once from these actors, and I can't take credit for it. They just brought themselves. The only thing I could do is kind of meet them and bring the same level of dedication.
As a kind of director, was it challenging? You have this very kind of limited space, really, this like house in the middle of nowhere and sort of the surrounding grounds. Was that a challenge for you as a director to keep finding innovative ways and exciting ways to shoot this kind of location?
It was something that I thought about when I chose the location in the first place. And then once we had chosen it and secured it, I didn't really worry about it too much because there was just, it was a very visually interesting place and I just took advantage of it. So it's not something I worried about once I was there. It was more something I like delighted in, where I was just like, this lake is awesome. And wow, at 5 a.m, this dense mist covers everything. And, you know, it was more just being excited and playful in terms of using what was already there. So it was really more in the choosing of the place that I thought about that.
And you mentioned like the mist, I mean, that image of the mist obviously opens and somewhat closes the film. And then you also have kind of the posters and artwork. Did you kind of see when you first saw that kind of mist thinking like this could be quite an iconic image for the film for putting it out there?
Yeah, I didn't imagine a mist-covered lake when I wrote the script. I wanted a beautiful lake, of course, and I also wanted no houses on the other side of the lake, which was very difficult to find. This house happens to be across the lake from a national forest, so there wasn't allowed to be any building on the other side of it, which was perfect. So that's the kind of thing I imagined. But when we got there, we saw the mist cover everything. And in some ways I thought, oh, this is more akin to the spirit of the movie, because for me, the movie is about the transformation of negative energies into positive energies through art. And I felt like the blank slate, the mist, really reflected her mind at the beginning of the artistic process, which is cloudy, hazy, and formless. And then through your reflection and through your craft or whatever, you start to shape a narrative. So I thought, okay, let's go with this mist, even though it wasn't scripted. And then I also wanted people to see the beautiful lake without it. So then we put that into the actual, you know, there's the interstitial section of the movie and then there are the two other sections. So I wanted people to see the lake and I just put it in the part one and part two, and then the interstitial was misty.
We've kind of touched on it, the narrative and the different parts. What was kind of the shooting process like for that? Was it something that you shot kind of, you know, following kind of the script, or how did you sort of bring all of the two elements together in terms of, do you shoot kind of part one first, then into part two, or do you sort of just have a kind of thing where you're acting out scene one from the beginning of the film, and then later on that afternoon or evening, it's kind of towards the end of the film? Or was it very much decided for kind of keeping track of everything and for the actors' performances to kind of shoot in a script fashion?
We shot chronologically for the most part. There were anything that was shot at the dock at night was shot on the same day, regardless of when it occurred in the narrative. So that was the only thing that was out of sequence. And that was because we needed a light that mimicked the moon, and it was too expensive to have for more than a day. So everything else we shot in order. I thought it would help the actors. And I also thought it would help the cinematographer and I, because the two parts are shot in different styles. The first part of the movie has no handheld, and the second part is all handheld. So just mentally, the gymnastics that it would have added if we shot out of sequence, to be like, okay, how are we shooting and lighting this scene, because it's going to be in part two. And it was easier for us to just get in the zone of a particular part and make all our decisions with that bent of mind, and then convert. So it was for the actors and for myself and the DP. I don't know how much it benefited the actors. I've talked to them about it a couple times. They don't know either. It was an easy concept because it was Chris and Aubrey barely knew each other before the shoot. And so, for example, it makes sense to shoot their first scene together at the beginning of the movie before they really know each other, because those two characters don't know each other. Only thing is, actors are just good. They know what they're doing. So I don't know that you really need to do that, or I don't know that it translated in any way. But anyway, we did shoot chronologically, by and large.
And finally, we touched on obviously this narrative switch and the twists and turns the film has. Is it difficult to market a film like this, where you watch the trailer, it very much is front loaded with the first half, little flashes of the second, even kind of our conversations today, we're dancing around elements of the film. Is it a challenge for you when creating trailers, discussing the film, promoting this film, about what this film really is?
Yeah, it is, because the film is mysterious. It actually ended up being more mysterious to people than I thought it would, or even hoped. But it is interesting to read like the Reddit thread about what this movie is about. A lot of them really understand it, so I guess it's not that unclear. But let's see. I'm not really in marketing, so I thought about it very little. It's more than I can handle to be a good storyteller and to learn. To continue to learn and grow in that area. So I haven't given much thought to marketing, but it is hard when you're asked what the movie's about, because it does have this element of ambiguity, and that people who like the film seem to enjoy, and I don't want to ruin that for them. So I don't really want to just like say, here, look, this is what it's about, and it's actually kind of simple. but anyway, so yeah, that's a challenge. And then in terms of the trailer, I mean, that was kind of a nightmare. Like, I just think I love what they did with the trailer. I think it makes the movie look really intriguing, but I really conceived of the movie to be a big surprise when part two kicks in. And the trailer reveals more than I would like, but I didn't really see any other way to construct a trailer, so I just had to live with it.
Thanks so much to Lawrence for joining me, and up next is journalist and documentarian Scott Marshutz, whose documentary, Let Him Play, follows a group of hopeful athletes looking to be part of the US Paralympic team and competing in Tokyo 2021. Their journeys are filled with unique trials, from injuries to training disruptions, rule changes, and much more. Aligning with the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the film aims to bring awareness to the importance of inclusive legislation while telling a compelling story about four inspiring young people with disabilities and showcasing how simply the opportunity to compete positively impacted their lives, families, and communities. Scott takes us on his journey to bringing this film and stories to life, and Let Him Play will be available on both pay-per-view and VOD from April 20th. Thanks too to Scott for joining me, and be sure to catch and most importantly support Let Him Play from tomorrow.
And together, our Olympians and Paralympians brought home more than 200 medals from London.
And that was really a purpose of this initiative. Why go to California?
To include and increase the opportunities for students with intellectual and physical disabilities.
Now, being disabled myself, it's like, no, you're not going to get away with that with me. And
do I want to train for hours and hours for a 20-second race?
It'll take a bit of time. It will. We are a huge state.
I usually don't get to see that when I'm running against my regular high school teammates.
She's going to have to put in a lot of work to make the next world team.
Look, two bags, a surfboard, and a bicycle. That's the way you want to go to college right there.
So she was on probation when she competed at state.
They like had me lay on a table, did a bunch of like stretches with my arm. They looked at it.
But she's really blossomed already in the long jump.
So there's two things going on. One is they got rid of that event, his classification for Tokyo, and two, everybody needs to be classified.
The fact that they're competing at a high level is by far the most important thing right now.
Yeah, I hope I didn't break it. I hope it's just a sprain. I don't know what I'm gonna do if it's broken.
This film, you were a journalist. What inspired you to make the leap into sort of making a feature documentary? What's been your journey?
For a long time, I wanted to produce a documentary film. I'd been inspired by the documentary genre way, way back, you know, all the way back to high school. My father was a commercial director, and my mother was really into film. And I was, you know, kind of brought up in the sort of the mid 60s, I guess. And when some of the, you know, documentary filmmakers like Dave Pennebaker and Bruce Brown and the Maysles brothers were really, you know, going strong, and they had a lot of effect on me, and their films really inspired me, you know, when I was 11, 12 years old. But for whatever reason, I took sort of the traditional journalism route, and then when there was severe contraction, you know, in traditional media, you know, back around the late 90s, you know, early 2000s, I was looking at other ways to make money and looking at other projects, and just started making some one-off little music videos and news clips and stuff like that, and it kind of grew from there. But I really wanted to make a feature documentary. And I've always been involved in sports and music. Those were the two big things for me. And so I was pitched by a PR company on this story, you know, as a, you know, they were reaching out to me to see if I wanted to write about it. And that event was the Angel City Games, which is held pretty much annually at one of the universities out in Los Angeles, UCLA, except for obviously last year. But it was a really good pitch, and I was really drawn to it. And I, you know, got in my car and drove out there and was blown away. All these disabled athletes were competing from 6 years old to 60 years old. And it was a university that I didn't really know anything about. I mean, I knew the Paralympics existed because they come after the regular Olympics every 4 years. And I knew all that part. And I knew, you know, the events, and I was familiar with track and field and stuff, but I'd never seen it live in the para, you know, universe. And I thought, wow, this is like more than just one story. This could be a film, you know? So I started doing my research, and one thing led to another. And I found out about this huge rule change in the state of California that now allowed high school disabled athletes to compete, on more of a level playing field, and created their own division, and it gave them some incentive. And I sort of like angled off of that, and that's kind of where it all started.
They've pitched to you, they're interested in you sort of telling this story. Do you bring your own sort of idea to it, where you're like, okay, I hear your pitch, but then with my journalism background, I think I might have a different way to maybe tell this story? Or was it very much like, this is how we kind of want the story to be told?
No, it's a great question. We looked at, you know, several different angles. You know, what would be, what's the strongest angle to sort of the lesser ones? And the one I kind of focused in on was that, you know, the state of California became, I think, the 25th state to adopt these rules at the high school level. So that was one angle. The other angle was, you know, it's really easy to follow the top three athletes, you know, into these high stakes Paralympic, you know, competitions, you know, but where do they come from? And what is their path to get there? And what do they need to get there? And those were the kinds of things I was looking at, you know? So we looked at, you know, we sort of cast a wide net, you know, maybe 8 to 10 athletes that we could logistically follow, you know, over sort of a three, you know, one sort of cycle, if you will, you know, a 3.5 year cycle, to see what they could do. So that was the other angle. Through a series of, you know, like a happenstance situation, I met another guy that had been involved in para-athletics. He'd been a track and field official, and he knew everybody. And so we sort of partnered up, and we found out we had three major things in common. We'd both gone to the same university. We'd been in the Marine Corps at different times, and we were both from New York, and we sort of hit it off, you know. And so he got me access into places that I couldn't get into. And we just started developing from like that.
What was your kind of pitch to these kids and probably their families as well, to get them to commit to making a documentary, in addition to schooling, training, and probably teenage life as well, to find out that they're willing to make this commitment to your project as well?
Yeah, no, that was a challenge, because, you know, all the kids that we, you know, we were able to get into the documentary were under 18. So we had to get, you know, buy-in from their parents. You know, at first they were a little skeptical, but they understood the need to promote para-athletics, especially in the United States, because in the U.S., it's so underserved. You know, with the exception of the lead up to the games, which is obviously this year, you know, canceled from last year and now rescheduled in Tokyo for 2021. But in off years, you don't see any media in the U.S. doing anything on para athletics, because there's so many other sports to cover. You know, I don't know, the major media outlets just don't have time. They're just not interested in whatever. But so the parents understood the need for this movie, especially at the level we were doing it at. And I think so that inspired them, and that got them interested. And they thought, okay, well, here's a guy who's serious about making a movie about this universe. Let's get into it. Let's get involved. And so they were tremendous to work with. They were all very, very supportive.
When I kind of think of like the Paralympics, and much like the Olympics, it was when I was watching the documentary, I think I watched someone do a shot put or run 100 meters or any of those other events, and it's like done in a minute. And then it was one of those things where I'm thinking of like your film and the process these people go through, and I'm like, the long journey these people have to that 1 minute. And I'll watch these people on the TV and I go, wow, what an incredible achievement. And then you never hear about these people kind of again, or there's not a focus on them after what their journey was. Was it important for you to try and capture that journey, to show what goes into that 1 minute, those few seconds of, you know, running 100 meter dash almost?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that all the films so far doesn't really show. I mean, you know, they, you know, we track them, and not only on the athletic field, but, you know, in their high school life and their, you know, sort of life outside the Olympic, you know, Paralympics or para-athletic competition. And so we wanted to document that, that, you know, what does it take to get to that point, to get to that competition? And, you know, the three big things that stood out were coaching and resources and parental support. And, you know, if the athlete had all those components, you know, they'd have a better shot at it than the ones that did not. And so it was important to show that, definitely.
From sort of the original idea to day one, you're shooting, how long did it take for the film to start? And was it a challenge to find people to fund this kind of first time feature? Or was there a lot of buy-in? As you say, there seems to be a lack of, you know, interest or time within the media. Was that a worry that you had going, oh, are they going to have a lack of interest in my story, in my film?
Yeah, you know, sort of the two-part answer. I was lucky enough to have the resources where I didn't have to do a big fundraising campaign. You know, we had a small budget, and we were thinking if we could make like a really good film with a small budget, we'd be okay. So I was able to, you know, partner up with my crew, and they were really excited. When I took them out to the first event, their jaws just dropped open. They had no idea. They had never seen anything like this. And with that, they were so sort of inspired by it themselves that they were willing to go negotiate their pay rates. So I wouldn't have to pay them, you know, the full freight, like on a normal film. And a lot of people, you know, I was very lucky in that area. So that was able to keep my expenses down and be able to stay within budget, you know, over that 3.5 year period. So that's kind of how that took place. But, you know, if we're going to do another one, sure, you know, there'd be a lot of fundraising going on. So
with your kind of structure with the interviews, what do you bring sort of from your kind of journalism background into the role as a director and interviewer? What was that kind of like stepping up to a new role, and what could you bring with you?
Well, it's preparation, it's research, you know. It's like with my colleague, Rich Robert, who I mentioned earlier, you know, we would get together and talk about, you know, the you know, what was happening during these competitions. And so I would prepare a list of questions for all these, you know, athletes and their parents to talk about some of the obstacles they hurdled along the way. You know, there was a time where, you know, these athletes were coming in to get classified before they could even compete on an international level. And, you know, shortly before, you know, their classification was to take place, there was such a huge demand for other more seasoned athletes to get classified. They had a chance of maybe not getting classified at all. So, you know, all that was done in preparation, you know, for the interview. So, you know, once we hit them with those questions, they were like, oh, wow, you know, yeah, it was really stressful. We weren't sure what was going to happen. So I think, you know, you talk to any writer, any journalist, you know, they're going to tell you got to do the prep up front, you know, to get the good questions, to get the story. And that's really, you know, how we were able to get the story out.
How long did you sort of, you touched on it, that you spent sort of 3.5 years filming it. What would be like a typical year like for record making your kind of film? Was it very much dictated by these events going, right, these are our markers where we'll kind of check in with people? How did that sort of, how do you kind of plan for 3.5 years?
Yeah, you know, we didn't shoot those whole, you know, all year long. It was just during the season. So we would look at, you know, where the athletes were competing. You know, could we get to them within a fairly easy drive without having to load up a plane and spend, you know, a lot of money doing that? So it was all about sort of, you know, keeping our eye on sort of logistics and what made sense and, you know, where we could get the best footage and, you know, could we get media access, and all that was done sort of, you know, in advance. So we would shoot probably, you know, the season really starts here in the United States, you know, the para-athletic season starts about May. And it runs through November, depending on the year. So we would shoot probably once a month for 3 or 4 months, and then take a break and then come back to it. And that's how we accumulated the footage that we got, in addition to stock footage and other things that we were able to find to fill in the blanks and all.
One of the things when I was watching it, I kind of always sometimes think, what would I watch this film with? What would I pair it with? And by the end of the film, I thought I would watch this with like Boyhood, for example, that period of like they follow this boy over sort of 12 years and how he grows and changes, and you sort of see that physical change. And that surprised me because you forget sometimes, I'm now like, I'm someone in my mid-30s, and you forget what it's like being a teenager, where the skins, the spots come along, you know, tattoo, like piercings come along, people's attitudes change. That I remember being like bang into rugby when I was a teenager, and then I got like a weekend job, it was gone. And it was so fascinating to watch within this period of time how these people physically change, their attitude changes to sport. Was that potentially like a worry for you, kind of seeing that they might lose interest in something like this? You might invest 2 years in someone, and then the last year and a half they're like, it's done for me. And what was it like on a personal level to spend that kind of 3 years with these people and watch their journey and watch them grow?
It was amazing. Very inspiring. Took a lot of things away from it. You know, became, you know, a lot, very emotional at times. And, you know, these kids, you know, it's tough. You know, some of them, you know, the ones that have some resources, it's a little bit easier, but the ones that don't, you know, you can see the difference. And you can see how that motivates them, you know. But then, you know, they have to hurdle other obstacles, like the system changing the rules, and you know, they just can't make it all work because of their schedules and the demands on their schedules and things like that. So and I thought that was really interesting, you know, that, you know, wasn't just a free ride for them. You know, some of them needed to work and pay their bills, and they weren't being given a lot of money. And, you know, or they had school commitments or work commitments, and then they had to try to fit in the training in between all that. And so it's, you know, and that's another thing we really wanted to show, is that because when you watch the Paralympic Games, you know, and you see some, you know, profiles of athletes and stuff, they don't really get into a lot of that. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't get into the real struggles of how they got there, and what it took and to get to that point.
Did you have sort of an eye on, like you mentioned that the sort of the Olympics had ended, the kind of Olympics got cancelled last year and got postponed, and obviously the Paralympics too. Did you have an eye on that being a potential endpoint of your documentary, that kind of maybe 4 year journey to getting to the Paralympics? Or did that have to, was that kind of thrown off when sort of it got kind of postponed altogether?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, the cancellation, the whole year of being affected by, you know, the coronavirus actually played in our favor. And it was amazing how that whole thing happened. Originally, my idea was if we could get it done right before the Paralympic Games and have it sort of marketed as sort of pre-event content, that was the original goal. But when it got canceled, I was able to, you know, regroup and like take my time, and we spent a little bit more time editing the film, and then you know, luckily we were able to get a distributor on board, you know, pretty quickly, and so that whole process took from we finished the film in July of last year. It was like, I think I did a soft sort of premiere just on my website like July 12th, but we didn't sign with a distributor until October. And then from October until January, we had to deliver a lot of stuff to the distributor, as you probably well know, There's a lot that goes involved in that. So it took some time to meet all those requirements. So, you know, while that was all happening, you know, athletics was pretty much shut down. So there was nothing going down. So by the time we got, you know, everything together, it's now, you know, it's after the first of the year, it's 2021 and everything's are starting to change and like open back up. And the timing just turned out great for us. And so we were very, very lucky in that regard.
One thing that got me really curious when I was watching the film is like it's just over an hour long. And as you mentioned, you spent 3.5 years following these people, their highs, their lows, these multiple people. What was sort of like, I know like assembly cuts can always be deceptive. What was like that sort of original length that you've had to kind of edit down from? And was it a challenge to keep it so tight?
Well, I wanted to keep it tight, you know, originally. We didn't want to go over about an hour 10. You know, I figured we could tell these four stories in an hour. And I think I was really trying to tailor it to the viewer's interest, you know. You know, pacing is very, very important in these films. And if we had, you know, we had let it out at, you know, maybe 90 minutes or something, would have been way too long. So we wanted to keep it tight, keep it rolling, keep the pace, you know, pretty quick, you know, but meanwhile, be able to tell a thorough story for each one. And, you know, credit goes out to my editor. Jennifer was just, she's just amazing. And I mean, there's a couple of backstories there where, you know, back January, you know, we started to edit the film like January of 2020. And she spotted some holes like right away. Mm-hmm. And then right before the shutdown, I get this urgent call from her and she says, Scott, you got to go out and re-interview a couple of these athletes because we're missing a couple pieces here. And if you know, if we had them, it'd be a lot better film, you know, and if you could get a crew together and get out there and shoot this and get it back to me, you know, we could get it in. So I'm like, oh my God, there was rumblings, you know, in the state about the shutdown and, you know, is anything happening and could I get it all together? And so luckily I was able to get a hold of the athletes, you know, get the interviews, the pickup, you know, shoots done, and get the stuff back to her, you know, within, you know, like right before the shutdown. Last interview we did was the day they shut us down, wow, you know, in California. And I'm like, man, that was lucky. You know what I mean? So that's the kind of thing we went through.
Was there anything that was like painful to cut that you think, oh, it was like, you know, the kill your babies with editing. Sometimes you think when you watch the film thinking, there's a really great story that I couldn't put into that film, or a really sad moment that I think could get kind of people misty eye. What was the toughest cut for you?
You know, it's always the case. You know, we had not only a good editor, but a very good story consultant on board. And we battled, we debated back and forth about, you know, what should be taken out and which we put back in and what could help the story and what is just, you know, truly just sort of fat. So there was a lot of, you know, push and pull and, you know, kind of a tug of war there. I think the cut that we ended up with is pretty decent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of other people have complimented us on that. And, but I just think it's sort of a natural, you know, debate between, you know, the director and the editor and the people involved. So there's really, to answer your question, there wasn't really one particular clip or one particular thing that, there was a whole bunch of them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we had a finishing editor and we trimmed it even more. You know, it was just a really interesting process. Because everybody's coming at it from a different angle. And everybody's sort of got their, you know, sort of like a little agenda, you know, about what would play better than wouldn't play better. So it's just kind of like, you know, push and pull.
As a kind of your first time director, what surprised you about this whole process, kind of as the film is close to release now, looking back on the past kind of 4 years plus, what's kind of surprised you about this job that you've taken on?
You know, it was all good. I loved every minute of it. I can't wait to, we're developing a couple of new projects right now. I can't wait to get into them. You know, I've sort of started this late in my career. You know, most guys are into it in, you know, their mid 20s, early 30s. And here I am, you know, way past that. But I still have the energy and the motivation. And it was, you never know what's going to happen on your first one. But I would, you know, during that whole process, I was taking these online seminars, you know, from other filmmakers and other, you know, actors and producers that were saying, look, just finish it. You know, once you finish it, you'll have something under your belt. So just, you know, try to get to that finish line, you know, nail it and you'll have an asset and you'll be able to sell off that. And that was kind of the mindset I took that, you know, no matter what happened, you know, we were going to get this thing done.
What do you hope people take away from this documentary?
It's a great question. And we've talked about this a lot. You know, if you're a viewer, and let's say you're a parent and you're a parent of a disabled child, doesn't matter what the disability is or the impairment is. And they want to play sports and they want to, and they're and good at playing sports, but they don't know how to get into it. This gives them a path to at least, you know, try, depending on where they are, obviously in the country or the world for that matter, to say, hey, I think I can be that person. I think I can do that. You know, I want to do that. And that's what we're hoping, that it'll wake up a lot of parents to say, hey, you know, maybe, you know, our kid can, you know, get into this and here's how they can do it. And, you know, hopefully they have an advocate, you know, at their school or whatever the situation is that could help them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's next for the film as it begins its journey into the world? I say it's going to be released kind of almost ahead of sort of the Paralympics being released. Are you hoping there's going to be a nice bit of synergy between the two as well?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're hoping, that, you know, this this will be up on, you know, Shaw Communications in Canada and iTunes and Amazon and Cineplex beginning April 21, which is, you know, just a few months before, you know, the Paralympic and Paralympic competition start. So I'm hoping that people will get interested and watch it and then, you know, obviously continue and watch the games after that. But it's it's a different take on the whole thing. You know, we watched a lot of films that were related content, obviously, before we made this one. And so we try to do something different. We just hope it, you know, resonates with the audience.
Absolutely. And you touched on it, you're working on a few kind of projects yourself. Is there anything you can kind of tease at the moment, or is it still very much in that kind of a development stage?
Yeah, you know, these things are fragile. They're really in sort of pre-development and early development. And I would hate to, you know, say anything more, you know, at this point, but they're cool projects too.
And for people that want to keep up to date with the release of the film, the news of anything that's kind of happening with it, where's the best kind of places to follow the film and yourself, Scott?
Well, I'm posting a lot of clips and updates on my Instagram page and my Facebook page. So it's at Marshoots Productions, real easy. M-A-R-S-H-O-O-T-Z Productions. So they can follow me there or my website, which is marshootsproductions.com. And then we have, if they can't wait for April 21, they can actually watch the film at letemplaydocumentary.com. There's a, you know, a paywall up, but all they have to do is throw in a dollar and they can watch the film. So that gives them a few options right there.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Scott. It's a really fantastic film and I'm looking forward to seeing, hearing people's kind of reactions as it goes out into the world. I think there's a lot of people that will resonate with the film, but also kind of get behind these people and be cheering them on their couch.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Lee, for having me on.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.